Welcome to Digging the Dharma, where we dig into the Buddhist Dharma and explore ways to bring these 2,500-year-old teachings into our lives. I'm Doug Smith of Doug's Dharma on YouTube and the online Dharma Institute.
And I'm John Aaron, teacher at New York Insight Meditation Center and mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher and teacher trainer and founder of Space to Meditate.
Well, hello, John. Good to see you again today.
Likewise. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Doing all right.
I think when this actually airs, I'll be still in the hospital. So it's kind of weird to talk about what will be happening.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. We're sort of recording this just sort of the week before.
Yeah.
The week before you're going in.
But, I've had a lot of support and it's going to be an interesting experience. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So. You'll look back on it. With interest, it'll be an interesting experience.
You know, and it'll be also interesting to see how my practice actually sustains me through the process.
Right, right. Yeah, and I'm sure we'll be interested to hear about that on the other side.
But for now.
Yeah, but today we're going to be talking about something a little bit more, I don't know, it has nothing to do with what you're going to be going through.
No. It's one of the three poisons of... You know, three poisons are greed, hatred,
and desire,
delusion. And so we're going to talk about greed, which is desire and greed. There's a difference between the two. And we were talking about earlier, one of the things that kind of prompted the discussion for me is this article I was reading or was listening to about the Getty family and a financial advisor to this family they're all suing each other now.
Getty is the family that made Getty Oil, right?
John Paul Getty,
Sure.
And how John Paul Getty himself, who the initial patriarch who made all the money, initial money, right? He was so greedy, he kept all his money and he was very miserly. The funniest thing was that he had a payphone in his house for his guests, in one of the houses, which is like mind-boggling to me that, but it's also the Christmas Carol and, that kind of character that you hear about. And then, just how people what was interesting in this article is that two of the heirs who were actually illegitimate children of one of the grandsons, but who received money as part of it was put in a trust for them, and they were planning to invest in things that weren't oil, ethical investing as it's called, or I forget what there's another term for it now, and this financial advisor was specializing in that. But then at some point they got caught up in their own greed and not wanting to pay taxes and things like that. So, there's that kind of greed, which is, pretty obvious. But I think when it comes to our practice and those of us who aren't gazillionaires, perhaps have some desire to be millionaires or billionaires or whatever, I mean, that may be part of it. But they're the subtle forms of desire, and there's that difference between healthy desire and unhealthy desire. And, how do we work with that, and how do we know?
Yeah, and I think it's important to make that distinction between healthy desire and unhealthy desire, because I think a lot of people come to the Buddhist Dharma, certainly a lot of people in my comments come to the Buddhist Dharma with the impression that the whole point of practice is to give up all desire. As if that were really possible, as if it were possible to live a life literally without any desire at all. And the Buddha doesn't talk about giving up all desire. And within the early texts, it's not really well defined, but there's a clear sense that there are certain of our desires that are perfectly normal and healthy, and there's nothing particularly wrong with them on a worldly sense. And then there are the ones we're talking about today that are a problem because they're not healthy, they're not skillful, they lead to bad ends, either for ourselves or others or both.
Right.
So It's important that we keep that in mind. There's nothing wrong with, you know, wanting to have a meal because you're hungry.
Right. And what's interesting, I mean, John Paul Getty was not a happy man for one.
Sure. And this is the thing. A lot of these people are not happy.
Yeah.
And you think that the sense of somebody's so wealthy, they must be, but they're not.
No. You know? No, you can look at current examples of that. I mean,
sure.
You know. Or, you know, they get something and they're really successful and then they want more. Elon Musk, case in point, you know. Suddenly he's not one of the richest, he's no longer the richest man in the world, you know, because he decided he wanted more power, you know.
Yeah.
So, but,
it's this bottomless pit of desire.
Yeah. And, you know, it was funny when I was on retreat in November, you know, and as we've talked about here, it was a monastic retreat. And one of the rituals on a monastic retreat is that the yogis, serve the monastics their lunch. And the way it works, at least at the forest refuge, is that the lunch is put out and, you know, four or five of us will be on one side of the table and the monks will come in and we put the food in their bowl. Now, they can't ask for more, right? They can turn it down, but they can't ask for it, right? So we would, you know, bring more up, and then if they wanted more, they would not, there would be no gesture, but if they had enough, they would stop. But then there were times where there were choices, like the salad bar, you know, or the salad dressings. And they're not always used to choices like that, right? So they would be pointing to what they wanted. And then one of the monks was talking at one point about the choice of three dressings, you know, three salad dressings. And he finally just gave up and said, you choose. You know, so it's like, you know, that takes that desire away from them in a sense. If they wanted one, you know, they, on the other hand, if they did want a specific one, they would ask. But of course, this is perfectly healthy. You know, there's nothing, this is not causing any harm, basically. You know, so if we think of that, you know, from that place, you know, if desire is not causing harm, and in fact, if desire is healthy and skillful, you know, then there's nothing wrong with desire. Until, right, we're clinging to it.
Sure.
Then that's when the suffering arises.
I mean, there's also the healthy desire as well for enlightenment, for awakening.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in, you know, in the early texts, there's a very interesting discussion between, as I recall, Ananda and some other monastic or a layperson. And, basically the layperson is saying, you know, there's this, basically saying the equivalent of, you know, there's this paradox, you know, that you guys believe that there's the end of desire, and yet you're desiring this, you know, this enlightenment. You know, how are you going to get around that? And Ananda says basically that the desire for getting better, for betterment, for enlightenment is skillful.
Mm-hmm.
But that as you get farther along the path, that desire will tend to weaken. And until you give it up, you're not going to be able to actually achieve the final goal. But it's very skillful as you're getting yourself towards that goal, basically. And I thought it was very interesting, this idea that that as you get closer, the desire for it will tend to diminish. I mean, once you do reach the final end, that end would be the end of all, you know, of those kinds of desires anyway. So you'd have to give up all kinds of clinging for that. So, but I thought it was an interesting discussion. So,
yeah, and what's interesting, I mean, depending on which story you believe, right? There's the, you know, because Ananda himself didn't achieve the final awakening.
Didn't achieve enlightenment until after the Buddha's death.
Until literally gave up, in a sense, right?
Well, yeah.
I mean, yeah,
it was
a little bit,
it was very convenient that he became enlightened just before the first convention after the Buddha's death, you know, where the monks all got together and discussed the all of the suttas. And, Ananda remembered them all. Nobody else did.
And he couldn't take part until he was an arahant or something.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a story. So that obviously those kind of desires are fine, you know, are good. And, you know, even you know, a desire to achieve something is not a bad desire until we are, when we find ourselves, of course, attached to the outcome, then we're going to suffer. And, you know, we have to really, that's a very fine line for most of us. How do we know, first off, when we're, you know, attached? How do we know if our desire to achieve whatever it is going to be harmful or not? I mean, we can, on one level, we can understand or at least intellectually know that it's not meant to harm. But then there are the unintended consequences, you know, which, and again, it comes down to intention. As long as our intention is wholesome, and I think included that in, you know, and this is where the practice can be really helpful. So our intention can be wholesome, but if we haven't considered the unintended consequences, then our mindfulness has not fully taken hold, I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. And that's a big one. I mean, I certainly have found myself in those situations any number of times where, you know, the unintended consequences of something I said are not seen ahead of time.
Sure.
And then I'm surprised, you know, when somebody is hurt.
Yeah.
And that's where...
But that can be endless. That can get us down a huge road of papancha proliferation,
yes.
Because there's no end to our unintended consequences to everything
we
do.
Yeah. So we just have to be aware that that's, you know, that might happen. And, mm-hmm. you know, if it does, then we have to be prepared to ask for forgiveness or make amends in some way. But it's definitely part of our practice. You know, and then there's the material, you know, the obvious material desires that we have. And I was listening to another podcast. It's just a big, busy week for podcasts, I guess, about a guy who, I think he started a company many years ago called iFixit. And he was talking about, you know, how, and we've been doing this for such a long time, right? We live in a society, we live in a way that we will buy something new before we try to fix the old thing, you know, and computers are a case in point, mm-hmm. you know, that we will trade in our, or iPhones, you know, we'll trade in our iPhone 8 for an iPhone 13, even though our iPhone 8 is perfectly fine and works well. You know, but we want the new one without considering all the consequences that the building of that phone create, or the getting rid of our old phone create. And if we just thought about that more and we learned how to fix things ourselves, you know, and upgrade them ourselves, then, you know, we would be saving a lot in terms of the environment. So this also plays a big role in that.
Right. And so many things, well, this has been an issue for decades now. So many things are no longer made to be fixed, which is part of the problem with, I mean, for instance, with computers, iPhones, any kind of cell phone, they're, you know, to actually fix them takes an enormous amount of not only skill, but equipment, expensive equipment and training. And I mean, I remember when I was a kid hearing about like the Timex watches, which at the time were, you know, replacing a lot of the mechanical watches of the day that were sort of had been on the way out for a couple of decades. And I mean, the huge difference is the mechanical watches could be fixed. You would take it to a watchmaker. And in fact, I remember going to visit a local watchmaker around here where I am and talking to him about it, you know. Mm. And he was, you know, clearly... on the verge of retirement without any expectation that anyone's going to take his place. But yeah, you would take the watch to be fixed, to be oiled. And sure. If they had to replace, you know, one of the gears, they would replace a gear or whatever. But, you know, and then Timex came in, of course, a number of other companies. And the watches are made, you know, pressed metal that you could not open. And if you could open it, there'd be no way to really repair anything. There was no... source of repair replacement parts or anything, because there wasn't, you know, it just wasn't, they weren't built that way. They were built to be thrown out.
Wow.
So,
and now, of course, you know, to get a mechanical watch, a really good mechanical watch is in the tens of thousands, you know.
It depends. You can get a mechanical watch.
Of course. No,
for less.
I actually have one.
Yeah, you know, I have a couple. I mean, I love them,
Yeah.
The old ones, you know, the old ones you can get on eBay or something like that.
This idea of built-in obsolescence, you know, I mean, but that's right. That's a whole other.
Yeah. But
it has, I mean, what it's done is created a society which doesn't consider the impacts of that, you know, of what that means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the, you know, when we talk about dukkha and the causes of dukkha, you know, that could be seen as one of them. You know, our notion that there's, it's always better to replace than repair. It's always better to, without considering the fact that there's the thing that you're replacing has to go somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course there's unlimited resources and unlimited space, and that's the thought. Because it's all unlimited, why do we care? But of course we do care.
You know? There are a lot of, I mean, economic reasons as well. I mean, having to do with the cost of labor, skilled labor in particular. You know, a lot of what we own nowadays is made by sort of machines, basically, and is, as a result, not that expensive to make the first time. But if you want somebody to repair it, I mean, for instance, you know, if you want a good watch repairer to repair your watch,
yeah,
even if it's not that expensive a watch, frankly, you could get it on eBay for a couple $100. It'll cost you at least the price of the watch just to get it cleaned, which you have to do every 2 or 3 years. It'll cost you, you know, with a good watch repair. And this is one of the things that I remember hearing about, and you know, is that the people doing this work would say, look, you know, you say I'm charging $150 to do this and it's too much. Well, it takes me 3 hours to do it, you know, and I've got all this equipment and I've got, you know, all these, you know, oils that I have to buy that, you know, don't last forever to oil the watch. So, you know, I'm not charging really very much for my time to do this. Mm. And who among us has got, you know, $150 to drop on, you know, oiling a watch every 3 years or 2 years, which is what they need, you know. And if you don't do that, then they literally do fall apart and then you can't repair them, you know. So this is the thing. I mean, it's always a little bit more, you know, it's this kind of rabbit hole you get down about, you know, what do you prefer? Do you prefer to, you know, spend less money on your things but then have to throw them out?
Right.
Or do you prefer to spend more money and not throw them out? You know, this is the whole, I mean, this is the, you know, this is all this, I could get into this. This
right.
Is a big deal.
You know? We're getting a little off the Dharma here, but
yeah, know, it's a little off the Dharma.
Because after all, there is no time. So why do we even need the watch?
Yeah, right. That's true.
Yeah.
Well, it helps to record your right. your sitting time in meditation.
Yeah, right. To tell you. And, you know, we all have clocks on our phones.
Right.
So, but I mean, just going back to the greed, I mean, corporate greed, for instance, you know, it's like one of the things that this man was pointing out on who started this iFixit thing is that companies like Apple, they don't put their technical manuals online. I mean, part of that, of course, is for intellectual property, but part of it is just because if your phone or computer needs repair, they want you to bring it in.
Yeah.
And in fact, a lot of repairs can be done by, you know, you if you have a few of the tools and the manual.
Right.
And, you know, that always used to be done by the car manufacturers were the same way, but now they're not. And legally they can't be. They have to be able to let you get your car repaired where you want or repair it yourself.
Well, this is part of the issue is that it's changing and there are people who want this to be made into the laws. I'm not sure it actually is legal. I mean, a law, but people want it to be.
It's going from state to state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's pretty crazy. You know, a number of the car manufacturers say you can only buy the parts through us, basically.
Right.
And, you know, you can't have a third party making the, you know, whatever it is, the car parts, you know, so that you can take it to an independent mechanic to get it repaired.
So that's now,
or do it yourself.
Yeah, that is being rectified in certain states, but it has to be state by state. But it all has to do with corporate greed, you know, and then that corporate greed spills down into, you know, how we see the world, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And well, if they're going to be greedy, then I need to be greedy. So it's like, you know, really starting to see this clearly and just recognize when it's causing suffering. You know, if we just always return to that question, you know, what is causing this suffering at this moment? You know, is it an unhelpful desire? Is it mm-hmm. an unwholesome desire? Am I worried about losing something, or is it, am I actually striving too hard to get something in a way that's not helpful? You know, a lot of it, you know, when it comes to you know, a desire for someone, you know, let's see, you're attracted to someone and you want that person to be attracted to you, and you know, and you're really feeling it, and yet that person isn't attracted to you, you know, but is attracted to somebody else, then of course you feel jealousy, you know, which is a form of suffering, you know, and of course, in a really unhealthy situation, that can become dangerous, you know, in a not unhealthy situation, it just becomes a serious form of jealousy and suffering. And of course, the counterbalance to that can be resonant joy, or just our ability to let go, you know, yeah. This practice of letting go is at the root of our practice as well. I mean, it's, you know, we just have to recall and remember that whatever we're desiring is impermanent anyway, including the desire.
Yeah.
Right. So we may get what we want, but then in short order, I don't need it anymore. Right. Or I don't care for it anymore. It was not worth all the effort to get whatever it is, or I want something else.
Right. Yeah. And it can help to practice with renunciation and the benefits, to try to practice with seeing the benefits, the pleasure in renunciation, in not having more stuff that you don't really need
right. And
have to take care of, or practicing with generosity if you can, you know, giving things away, giving money away. All of these, I think, can be at least ways of subtle antidotes to some of our ordinary tendencies towards greed. You know, I mean, if it's having to do with other people, then, you know, trying to practice with the pleasures of being alone for a while. You know, being with other people is great, but sometimes it has its downsides too. You don't get to do what you want all the time because you've got other people to worry about.
It's true. So. It's, you forget. I mean, having just had my other half return after being away for 4 weeks, it's like, what, you mean I have to share this space again? You know,
exactly.
But it's also, you know, just worth kind of looking around your home at the things you wanted and desired and now you have, and what's your relationship to those things now?
Right.
You know, and just really taking that in and realizing, oh yeah, you know, not only that, considering like the fact that you're not going to be here forever, just taking that third reflection of all that we have that is near and dear, you know, will be lost to me, or will just end. And I like to think about, well, okay, if I were to like get hit by a bus today, all the crap that I have is going to be somebody else's crap, you know, and they're going to have to deal with it. And how fair is that? So it's like, it's really kind of.
I mean, and when we had our house fire, you know, one of the, you know, we lost a certain amount of stuff.
Of course.
And, you know, honestly, I mean, honestly, I wasn't so concerned about it, which is kind of funny because everyone kept saying, you seem so calm about it. And I was like, well, I mean, you know, it's just stuff.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because then at the end, when everything was sort of, you know, finished around, we got a bunch of it back. And it's like, oh, I thought I lost that. And I didn't really want it back.
Yeah.
So,
but, and, you know, and of course, you had the benefit of it, of a good insurance policy. So, you know, a lot of what you did lose is going to be replaced. But it's also interesting. I mean, and Patti was telling me about this, you know, on her return from India, because she was pretty much spending most of her time with people on the lower caste who weren't unhappy, you know, and they didn't have much. But they were there was a certain level of satisfaction. And You know, and we know that from, you know, historically, you know, Henry David Thoreau in, you know, his famous books, where he basically, you know, took on renunciation, as you said, and realized how happy he can be with so little. The simple, you know, the simpler life, the better. And we don't realize that until we actually allow ourselves to go there. And, you know, going on retreat is helpful because you do let go of most of your things, which identify, you're so identified with. Particularly going on solitary retreat can be helpful because you're also not with others, so there's no draw to others. And that's a great learning experience in letting go, even if it's only temporary, you know, and just kind of practicing that will, in fact, I think, in time, change one's view on having things, for one, and being able to let go of things for another, mm-hmm. without, oh, it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's argument for becoming a monastic, I guess.
Yeah, that could be. You know, we're not necessarily encouraging that because neither of us are.
No.
So it's, and or do we have a desire to be necessarily? And then you know, really exploring what desires are healthy and when those healthy desires slip into the unhealthy. You know,
right.
Again, it all comes back to knowing dukkha, knowing suffering, knowing the levels mm-hmm. of suffering, and when the suffering is felt, investigating.
Right. And remembering that the Buddha counseled a middle path, so that we shouldn't be beating up ourselves over, you know, normal desires for
right.
normal things, especially since we're lay people, we're not monastics. If we want to be monastic, then great. You know, that's a different path, but
don't think, you know, that's
lay
easy.
People have, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's yeah. not for yeah. sure.
But when you become a monastic, I suspect you are very quickly presented with all those desires that you were trying to get rid of. I mean, they just come up in the mind. They flood the
sure.
mind.
Sure. I was going to say, as Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about, you know, I mean, the monastics will desire a certain begging bowl then, or, you know, a certain kind of robe. You know, he talks about how, you know, you can get really nuts over, you know,
wow.
just having a particular kind of begging bowl or something like that. You know, I mean, because, you know, it just happens. It's just the mind, the way
yeah.
the mind works.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see a little, you know, in the monastics I was with early, you know, on the retreat, you could see a little looking at other people's begging bowls. They all look the same to me, but.
Well, yeah. It's a slight difference, yeah. right?
Yeah. And the Anagarikas don't even get a real bowl. They have to, like, just deal with the stainless steel thing, you know, it's kind of ugly. Oh. And it gives them, you know, desire to go into the full.
Yeah. Yeah. If I become a monastic, I'll get yeah. a nice bowl.
So, and better robes, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's an really important topic, just an important practice to just reflect on and investigate when it arises. So.
Indeed.
Speaking of healthy desires, I mean, there is, there is our desire for coffee, and maybe it's over the top sometimes, you know.
We make a joke about it.
Yeah, it's true. But, you know, it is an opportunity for you to support us by buying us coffee. And you know, and you can do that by going to our website, digginthedharma.com. You can become a member and join us on the show. At some point, we're going to have a couple of guests who are our members, maybe in the next few weeks. And we encourage you to do that, to cover our costs, because there are some costs involved with this show. And it's nice.
Yeah, you wouldn't think, but it is true.
Yeah.
Run a podcast is actually has monthly costs.
Yeah. And I have to say, I really enjoy it. I bumped into somebody the other day who had been listening to it. And, you know, it's really nice when that happens.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, friends and friend. I'll
yes.
see you next time, Doug.
And thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll catch you on the next one, right?
Yeah. And watch those desires. Okay.
There you go.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on your podcast directory. And please check us out at digginthedharma.com, where you can leave a comment, buy us a coffee, and even become a member. You can find out more about me, John Aaron, at johnaaron.net, and Doug at dougsdharma.com.